Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Strength Academy Podcast. This is Mundo, once again, joined by Grayson.
How's it going, everybody?
And so we didn't really have a specific thing that we wanted to talk about today, so we're kind of going to jump around a little bit on subjects, and hopefully you can keep up, and we'll try to throw in some interesting stories in there while we're at it. But what did you have in mind
off the bat, Grayson? So, based off just what was just happening is we're observing Mundo's cat frantically throwing itself all over the ground to attack my car keys that it knocked off the table. And he was saying that you found somebody wrote a book entitled, like, What Is Your Cat Thinking?
Yeah.
And we were just kind of laughing at the impossibility of knowing what, like, I think this is kind of interesting because in order to understand how a cat's thinking, we don't have a mechanism of not using language to kind of, like, think about ideas,
yeah.
Right? So, like, what an impulse of a cat to attack the shit out of my hand right now, what that impulse feels like is non-language,
right?
Right. So, whatever that urge is, isn't the way that we would say, oh, I need to fling myself on the floor and,
rub you myself know. Against some keys.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's kind of funny because clearly the lights are on, right? So clearly Pickle's planning stuff. You can see her sit down and stare at something like she knows she wants to do something. But you can't, you know, it's ineffable to say what it would be like to be her in that situation.
Yeah, because what happens is we anthropomorphize. We portray our emotions on the external object or that external thing. So that's usually a human way of thinking. It's man's way of thinking. It's how we interpret the behaviors of others. But when you do that with animals, it's anthropomorphizing. You're giving them qualities that they don't necessarily have, a consciousness that they might not necessarily have as well.
Yeah, so cat consciousness is got to have maybe some similarities to our own, but it's funny that people, because we spend so much time around our pets,
right?
We want them to have the same kind of, like, you know, thought pattern that we have.
Right,
like you
right.
want to think that your dog is, like, thinking about you as its best friend, but it might just be that you're super warm and that's why it's laying on you.
You always bring food.
Yeah, you always bring food. So, I mean, I think it's kind of funny to try to imagine what these animals are thinking as they frantically attack us while we record today. But no, I think as far as a weightlifting thing goes is... So I kind of wanted to talk about the merits of using super light technique work within a training program. You sometimes hear people kind of debate about how useful exercises are, even in like the sub 60% range. So a lot of times people won't count sets under 60% as volume within the workouts. You don't usually see a lot of, you know, 50% technique work kind of programmed in, or even empty barbell technique work. And I think that, at least in certain phases of training, it can be really useful to borrow a phrase from our friend Ben, do some extreme basics.
Extreme basics.
So, like, do you think that revisiting, like, super basic technique drills or really complicated ones where you're maybe doing an exaggerated position to work on balancing on the toes for longer and, like, developing, like, balance and coordination within the lift. Like, do you think that that has, like, merit towards actually increasing your lifts? Or do you think that just makes your lifts look prettier and it's kind of a trick that you can use? Because it seems people kind of have mixed feelings about this kind of work.
Well, so, like, there's two ways to approach it. The first way is to look at it as like a tune-up, right? The same way you kind of tune up your vehicle. You change your oil, you check the spark plugs, you look at the tires, you make sure everything's running properly. And so light technique work can kind of be like a tune-up. So something that you revisit every so often just to make sure that things are still running properly and still going smoothly. Now, is that going to make your lifts heavier in the end? It might, you know, but the point of technique work is to make sure that the weights that you're doing are sharp from the beginning to the end, right? So you want your lifts to look the same no matter what weight's on the bar. And so technique has to deal with how you maintain positions, how you perform the lift with and without load. So if you're able to mimic good technique with just the barbell and just ingrain those good movement patterns, eventually the hope is that you'll translate that into a heavier lift and not lose those movement patterns. Of course, it's hard to say that it's going to be the same, because when you're loaded, when you have 100 kilos loaded on the bar, it's not going to feel the same as an empty barbell. It's definitely not the same. But you should be trying to mimic those positions and maintain those same positions as you would as if it was an empty barbell. So is it going to add 5 or 10 kilos to your lift to do technique work loaded with an empty barbell? Maybe, maybe not. It just depends on how actively you're trying to transfer those skills into those later, like, heavier lifts. So it really comes down to, like, how you can take that technique work and implement it and solidify it as the weights get heavier and heavier.
Yeah, that's kind of how I look at it too, is if you're really revisiting, you know, and trying to be really diligent, because I think it matters how you're approaching kind of some of that stuff. And I think that it might just be a certain amount of mindset of the individual, because it takes a tremendous amount of focus to try to do 10 sets of 3 perfect snatches with an empty bar. Like, that takes an incredible amount of focus. So I think that one of the things that you might be doing is, if you add in an extra technical day during your preparatory phase, say, like, I'm not saying that you need to do these sort of things all the time, but adding in a technical day where you're kind of working every position that happens within that lift, you're doing slow pulls or pauses, or, you know, floating with your snatch high pulls, or going straight into muscle snatches, these sort of really light drills can let you know where you're feeling uncoordinated. Because usually, you know, I'd say that, you know, the vast majority of people that we work with are beginners and intermediates. And there's always an area, whether it's 2 inches below the knee or as you transition into the hip, that you've all, everybody's got that one area that feels awkward or they're not comfortable in.
Sure.
And using, you know, a lot of empty bar or very light technique work can help kind of gain, you know, familiarize you with that position. And I think that while it might not be doing anything for your strength, so, like, if you wrote a program that was 5 days of really, really light technique work, you might end up with a beautiful looking 40 kilo snatch, but if you're never, like, training it, you're not going to get stronger. So I'm not making the argument that doing, like, really repetitive light movements will make you stronger, but it'll make you maybe better coordinated, or maybe smoother, or maybe faster. And at least kind of give you a better understanding of where your balance is supposed to be. Because I think a lot of times missed lifts are due to being out of balance.
Right.
And the weight definitely, you know, changes your balance. And that's why making big jumps in the snatch feels so different, because that changes, you know, the timing and the balance. But I think that if you can get really familiar to the point that you can do a snatch pull at full speed and pause up on your toes for 3 to 5 seconds before coming back down and never losing balance, that's going to mean that you're just going to be more precise with your heavier lifts. So we're doing a bit of that in our cycle right now, and I've been playing with it a lot more myself as I'm kind of transitioning out of that more gymnastics training that I've been doing and getting back into weightlifting.
Right.
And again, credit to Ben for Extreme Basics, because I really like that idea of being really, really into getting those beginner progressions down. And I think that for a lot of people, after, like, you do a big competition, in that deload week, kind of go back and almost relearn how to snatch again, like re-go through a beginner progression of, this is how you do it from the hip, this is how you do it from the knee, this is the transition. Because usually, the reason I love that idea is that most of the time when you first learn how to lift, you're new to the gym, it's distracting. The amount of information that's sticking permanently from that first snatch session probably isn't all there. And after you've trained for a while, so maybe it's, you know, your second year of training, and you go and revisit the beginner stuff, the beginner progression, these are the positions, you're going to understand the snatch so much better going into it,
right,
that you'll have a totally different experience of revisiting the beginner progressions than the first time, because you understand what it's supposed to feel like now.
Right. Yeah, and that's a good way to look at it. I think that revisiting fundamentals is probably something that is valuable in and of itself. Because you're right, a lot of the time you learn the basics and there's a lot of information being thrown at you, and then you kind of forget some things as time goes on, or you don't remember exactly why we try to do something in a specific way. But when you revisit them, or let's say like you get programmed 30 minutes of technique work and you get to choose what you get to work on. Like, what do you work on? How do you choose what to work on? So you try to find those spots that are just kind of, they feel awkward, or maybe they're slowing down in the lift or the timing's off. And so like, that's a way to identify, it's to run that diagnostic test of how your lift is at this current point in time, as opposed to how it used to be, and then changing it into what it could be based on any adjustments that you make. So like, it's a good way to kind of fine tune where you're at and measure your progress, but also determine what you need to work on in the future as well. So it's a good way to revisit the fundamentals, yes, but also kind of check as a gauge, as a barometer of what you're doing and where you're at and where you need to be.
Yeah, because any of those positions that feel awkward, you can then look for those positions in your lifts. And sometimes it might just be that you didn't understand how active you were supposed to be in a certain position. But you might find that, oh no, my low back can't handle being awkward. Like with the light bar, this feels okay below the knee.
Yeah.
But when I'm loaded up, now I notice that position doesn't feel the same. And that's how you can identify, like, okay, well, that's a strength issue then. Because if you can move through that position and it feels comfortable until a certain point,
right,
that means that your technique is changing, not because you don't understand it, but because something is losing power. There's right. There's a lack of strength somewhere. So, I mean, if you're, you know, looking for, you can make it an active recovery day. It can be 30 minutes. You can cool down with a little bit of empty barbell drilling. You know, like if you had a workout and you're doing clean and jerks and you had a couple of unsatisfactory footwork events during your jerk practice, before you put the bar down, just take the empty bar and work your footwork a little bit. You know, doing a few extra reps, it's kind of the idea we've talked about before of getting some bonus work, like holding something for an extra period of time, or when you're warming up, doing some extra pauses at the positions that you find the most uncomfortable, rather than always trying to just get to the snatch working way.
Right.
Like, use the warm-ups to kind of highlight those areas as well.
And a lot of times, like, we'll include, like, lifting primers before you take the actual lift. So like, you'll have snatches programmed, but we'll have primer lifts like muscle snatches, or maybe some light hang snatches, or something that gets you moving in a certain way so that it'll prepare you to lift in the full classic lift. So a lot of time, like, some people just warm up snatches by snatching, but sometimes it could be valuable to just work through the positions in a slow, controlled way and work through some different technical aspects of the lift, and then try to translate those over into the full lift once you're ready to start, you know, putting weight on the bar. So I think that it's a good way to try to like dial things in at when there's not a lot of load on the bar.
Yeah.
And hopefully carry that over as you do load the bar progressively heavier and heavier, that you try to maintain those same ideas that you started with at the beginning of the session into that later part of the session when you're hitting those heavy singles, or, you know, whatever your working weights are at that time. So like, how did you, so technique work for you, was it something that you started off with, that like you started off weightlifting by learning technique, or was it just like, hey, let's just start snatching by throwing, you know, 55 pounds on the bar?
We did bad stuff when I first started. It was
okay.
right away. Well, because I entered in through the CrossFit context, and it was, you can put your arms over your head wide, and you can rip this off the floor and sort of power snatch it. So that's good, and you get applauded for that, and you get right. positive feedback from something that now in hindsight was kind of rough looking.
Yeah.
So it's stuff that I wish that I had done when I had started out, because, like, the most technique work we ever did was, like, the John North hit and catch drill, where you just work on bruising your pelvis over and over again to try to use your hips a lot in the turnover. Those were pretty much the only technical things that we did. I never spent any time focused on the quality of the lighter weights when I first started. And I think that's why I was, you know, plagued by injury for a couple of years. And then only after having to really relearn how to do everything did I start kind of really focusing on that. But I think that where my headspace was is I didn't really have anybody explain to me. Like, I understood long-term planning as far as you want to get stronger every year, and in 8 years you're going to be really strong. But I didn't take the get to where you own every position really well before loading.
Yeah.
So, like, we'd snatch and I'd run forward 3 steps. And just because I made it, I felt like that meant I had to put another 5 kilos on and go for it again and go for it again. Okay. So I tolerated a lot more sloppy lifting and questionable press outs and just general loss of position a lot, but my weights were going up, so I thought that meant I was getting better.
Right.
And I think that we have to distinguish between getting better and getting stronger. And
yeah,
you can be getting stronger without your technique getting better. And ideally, you want those two things to happen at the same time. So I think that if I had implemented more of this kind of very self-critical, like, really wanting every catch to be perfect.
Sure.
And trying to do, you know, even just once a week, like, if you're, you know, snatching 100, can you do the exact same snatch with 40 kilos 5 times in a row?
Yeah.
Like, where's your consistency in your movement? And I think that where you can kind of check to see is if you're going to be a person that'll really benefit from this is once your technique is ingrained and really efficient, you should basically never miss anything under 90%, right? Like 80% right. should be a lift that you can, like, warm up and make every time. 85% should feel kind of tough, but it's something that you should be consistent at. Like, your technique should be good enough that it doesn't break down until the weights are very heavy.
Okay.
Cool. But if you're in the position that if you're doing several triples in the snatch at 70-something percent and you miss half of them, then you're kind of...
Yeah. I get what you're saying. So okay, I have two questions, but the first one is, would you rather have a really technically proficient 90 kilo snatch or a sloppy, barely made it 100 kilo snatch?
Well, that's
if you couldn't have both, you know, like, if you couldn't have, like, if you could have one or the other, like, would you rather have the maybe less kilos but more technically proficient lift, or would you rather have the heavier lift that's not quite as pretty and, like, really just, like, you wonder how they got under it?
Well, I mean, and that's where it's so difficult, because if you round those numbers up by 30 or 40 kilos, would you rather place 15th or win the looking great, or win the Nationals looking kind of rough? You know, yeah, and sometimes that happens. Like, you see people that lift and, you know, like, in unconventional ways where it looks like it's like, oh my God, how could he possibly do that? Right. Like, Gore, the Armenian super heavyweight, his technique is so unconventional. Like, you wouldn't think, you know, like, I wouldn't teach anybody to lift like that, but oh my God, it looks great.
Yeah.
Because it's so, like, so heavy, it's impressive. Right. But I don't know. I think that, you can get too caught up in being all only focusing on your technique and never trying to get stronger. So you got to find that line between, like, that, maybe we'll call the line the 95 kilo snatch that was pretty good, but maybe not perfect.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. I think that you got to find that line. And maybe then it's the also in-between. About what's the urgency level?
Sure.
Is your family going to be kidnapped and murdered if you don't snatch 150 next week?
Yeah.
Or are you trying to be, you know, make training a part of your life for the next 30 years? Sure. And those two things are going to be different.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So it varies by like what your approach is and what your goals are and things like that. And what the urgency of the matter of like why you have to snatch that weight is.
Yeah, but I think that you should always be striving for having good technique because it'll allow you to lift heavier weights in the long run. But in the short run, it's really, really frustrating to be limited by, I know I could go up, but it wouldn't be, but my back would round.
Right.
And I can make it when my back rounds, but I don't want to make it when my back rounds.
Yeah. So there's that line of, like, knowing where you're technically proficient and knowing where things are going to fall apart, but you're still able to get it done. And so maybe riding that line a little bit and pushing the edges of your technique to see where things break down.
I think that's why, like, a phasic approach to training is important because if you're doing a 12-week cycle, in those first 8 weeks, you really shouldn't be missing anything.
Right.
Or if you do, it might be because you like kind of forgot what you were doing halfway up on a snatch or somebody walked in front of you, you got distracted.
Yeah.
But like you shouldn't be missing anything because your technique is breaking down in that phase. So the majority of your training should be spent like not kind of messing up with your technique. And you should be really focused on building that up and then letting yourself test the waters closer to competition so you can have a firm estimate on, okay, this is probably like third attempt is where my technique might break down a little bit, but I can probably get it if I just pull correctly.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of where I stand on that is you want to be trying to develop that technique.
Yeah.
And if you can step back from, I feel like I'm getting stronger every week, my squat keeps going up, like those kind of beginner times, and recognizing that proficiency and mastery is a like 5 to 10 year process.
Yeah.
And aiming for that rather than aiming for short-term success. And I think it's really hard to get people to buy into, I promise you'll be good in 3 years.
Yeah. Well, it's hard because like you show up and you want to put in the work and you want your work to have results, right? So you come in, you do your technique work, you do your strength work and things like that. And then it's a really long time before you get to test out whether or not you get to PR or not. And then if you don't hit a PR, you know, what does that say about all the work that you put in to this training cycle? So it can be real frustrating. So let me tell you about a little bit how I started learning the Olympic lifts. So I started off in the same kind of way that Grayson did. I was in a CrossFit gym and the emphasis wasn't really necessarily on doing it perfectly, but doing it good enough so that you could do the workout RX, right?
Yep.
So the goal was always to get to that RX workout level. And so that didn't mean that you were a proficient snatcher. It just means that you were strong enough to manhandle the weight to where you could get it over your head in a workout several times and not kill yourself. So eventually I adopted the mindset of like, I want my snatches to actually look good. Because sometimes you look around and you see people snatch and you're like, ugh, that's a tragedy, train wreck looking, you know, type of thing. And, you know, you see somebody nearly guillotine themselves and they have no idea what they're doing, but they're fearless enough to try to put that barbell over their head. And I've seen it happen multiple times in competitions to where people are like lifting in the heat of the moment a weight that they have no business lifting technically at all, but they're strong and they're brave enough to do it. So they try to get under it and they nearly pop their heads off with the barbell. But I took the approach of like, I want my lifts to look good. I don't want to just try to win. I want to play my best as well. So like the idea for me was to learn to snatch technically well and carry that over into workouts, even if it made me a little bit slower, even if it made me a little bit, you know, behind in the leaderboard. I would rather snatch well and do it technically in a more proficient way than to just manhandle it and get the workout done and just to say I got it done, have my name, you know, a few seconds higher on or a few places higher on the leaderboard. So yeah. as I drew away from that approach and I got more into weightlifting, rest in peace to Justin Thacker, but he was one of the individuals that put out like a technique primer thing where you would go through these steps and sequences to try to, you know, learn the lifts. And so
the ABCs
of Justin Thacker. So like between, so I first started off on the Bergner method and that was the CrossFit type, you know, ideology and methodology. And then I learned about Justin Thacker and the ABCs of the Thacker method. And I learned to snatch a little better. And so I wasn't great. I was still working on my own. A lot of the time I was still by myself in the corner of a CrossFit gym trying to learn how to weightlift. And I guess I can kind of say I'm self-taught, not entirely. Like I did kind of have a coach like that would check in with me every now and then. It was like, yeah, that looks pretty good. But like, so the second question after telling you that story about how I learned is like, do you think that good enough is good enough when you're learning the snatch, like snatch and clean jerk? Because sometimes I'll look at people in the gym and I'll say, you know, yeah, they're doing their best. They're working through it. They're trying hard. Or do I need to harp on them about being so technically proficient that I'm not going to allow them to put any more weight on the bar until they get this single thing down? And that's sometimes that's what I struggle with as a coach, is it's like, is good enough good enough? Like, should I let them keep going with what they're doing, or should I stop them and readjust everything to make it as perfect as possible?
Yeah, I think that line as a coach is really hard, because I personally believe that there's a certain amount of, like, you've got to work through it.
Right.
And you're never going to learn to snatch if you don't try to snatch.
Right.
And that's where, like, you know, if you're evaluating a lift, addressing the first error first, right, off the floor, kind of comes in. But yeah, I think that, you know, if you always harp on people to make it perfect before you let them go up, or like if one error happens, they have to take weight off the bar.
Sure.
I think that might be, I guess it might be like culturally not sustainable for, you know, recreational U.S. lifters, because right, their goal is to put some weight up. And if you literally make them do barbell work for a year,
yeah,
and never let them snatch more than 20 kilos, they're going to leave your gym. You can't do that. So what you want to do is you want to find where I like loading those kind of people where it's not quite perfect, but some are better than others. Like some, like even within a set, one of the three is really good.
Yeah. So what I like to hear when I'm coaching athletes and we're having this interaction between technique and loading the bar, I like to hear when athletes say, I don't think that one was that good, I'm going to redo that weight again. And that's a good indicator to me that they care enough about their technique that they want to redo it again to try to clean up some of the things that they thought were inefficient, but they're still willing to move on after that.
Yeah.
And so like, that's what I like to hear. That's what I like to hear from athletes is like, oh yeah, I didn't really like that one, I'm going to take that weight again. Even if it's a warm-up weight, you know, they're not quite to their working sets yet. Like even in the warm-up sets, they're like, I'm gonna redo that weight. I'm just gonna try to clean some things up and then I'll move on. But like, that's what I like to hear. That's what I like in the mentality, is it's like, yes, you're focused on doing things correctly, you're doing things proficiently, but you're also willing to move up and continue that process of loading the bar and trying to make weights as technically proficient as possible. So for me, that's a good indicator that they are mature enough as an athlete to know that, yeah, it wasn't perfect, but it's good and I'll keep working on it. And that's what I want to kind of like ingrain in the people that come to the gym, is just like, we're not going to hold you back because you're missing because of one small technical aspect, but we want you to recognize that you need to address that technical aspect and then move on.
Yeah. And I think that, that's why I really like, you know, when somebody does something and you see that they're not kind of satisfied with the lift.
Yeah.
As a coach, a really good thing to say is, what happened on that one?
Right.
See if they know.
Yeah.
And then if they can tell you, or when they start to say, like they make a lift and then they step forward and they're like, I just left it out. I just got to get my elbows up a little higher. Right. I like hearing that. I want people to be trying to self-diagnose.
Right.
Because I think it's really important for athletes to be able to feel when they make a mistake and not be reliant on feedback from the coach every time.
Right.
Because you want to develop the athlete's ability, like internal markers of, you know, technique. Like, oh, I know what it feels like when I leave the bar forward, and I could tell that that happened on that set.
Yeah. But if they're not technically proficient enough, if they haven't done enough technique work to know that something was off to begin with, then that's why we were talking about, like, adding that 30 minutes of technique work in, doing those barbell warm-ups, and sometimes revisiting technique. Just empty barbell work for like 30 minutes. And so like that'll help you keep those diagnostic indicators of what you're doing and how close you're keeping it and what you're doing in the lift sharp. And not just for the coach, but for yourself as an athlete, being able to tell when things are off and when things are out of place and making some adjustments on your own. Yeah. But like not relying on the coach all the time. Feedback is obviously an important mechanism and it's definitely a part of weightlifting. But if you can provide your own feedback and then explain that to somebody else, then you have a better understanding and a better overall picture of where you're at as a lifter.
Yeah. I think like a final thought would be, it's essentially, you know, using lightweight technique work is just to make sure that there's no part of the lift that you don't understand, that you fully understand what is happening at every phase in the lift, and your like comprehension of the timing and the feeling is correct enough that you don't have to do as much thinking when you get to your heavier weights.
Yeah.
Because I think in large part of almost everything, thinking is the enemy, right?
Right.
If you're caught up and your thoughts are just layering onto themselves of, okay, I got to keep the bar close off the floor and then come back when I pass the knees and then get flat footed here. And then all of a sudden you're three thoughts in, the snatch is already going upwards and you've forgotten to pull under.
Right.
So getting those things automated, I think that using light technique work, even for intermediate athletes during phases of training, for advanced athletes during the off season, maybe after a meet, just or revisiting it week. For a week or two, that sort of stuff can be really helpful for your training. So no specific exercise prescriptions, but just try doing a little bit more precision work.
Yeah.
Like every time you power snatch something really light, can you just be static and not stand up right away? If you fell over, you know that you did something wrong.
Right.
So I think that can be really, really useful. So, speaking of thinking, I had a good, we listened to an interesting thought experiment earlier this week, because I'm starting to get really worried that I don't have free will.
Yeah.
It's been eating my brain. And so I've been kind of exposed to this concept a few times, but I'm going to try to explain the thought experiment. So if you're listening, I just want you to pick a movie. So just think about it. It could be a movie you've seen, haven't seen. As long as you know the title, you can choose it. So that's your free choice. So once you've settled on the first one, let's maybe go ahead and pick a second, and then pick a third. And what I really like about this thought exercise is that when you think, I'm going to choose a movie, there's a few of them that pop up. And then you decide, okay, you create a narrative, right? Where you're like, okay, well, I've been thinking about whether Die Hard's a Christmas movie. So I'll choose Die Hard because that's been on my mind lately.
Which it is a Christmas movie.
It absolutely is a Christmas movie. No debate there. But the interesting thing is that this was used as an example of your lack of freedom of choice. So where you chose between those five movies that kind of pop up, which of the three that you would say that you thought of, if you went back in time and repeated, would you be free to choose a different set of movies? So because you didn't choose Pride and Prejudice it didn't occur to you to choose it. It was not one of the options that popped up. In what sense were you free to choose otherwise if it didn't even present itself as one of the options? So right. What I really liked about this analogy and what's been kind of terrifying is that the feeling of having, whenever you make a decision, there are these three or four options. You're like, okay, how am I going to drive here today? So when I drove here, I drove up Manal, but I could have taken the highway.
Right.
And then there's probably 8 or 9 other routes that I could have taken, but didn't occur to me or weren't efficient. So what you choose out of those limited options is a choice, right? So that's a conscious choice of yours. Right. But are you free to choose that which didn't occur to you? So if you're, you know, trying to figure out how to solve a problem, you know, you've got something in your life that's not going well, or even you're just like planning what to make for dinner.
Right.
It feels like a freedom of choice. It feels like you have the ability to say, okay, well, I can make lasagna, or I can make shrimp scampi. But, like, if borscht didn't occur to you, in what way were you free to choose that? If you rewound it 100 times, would you have actually landed on borscht ever? And the interesting thing with this is that the thoughts that are popping up are the result of metabolic activity in the brain. So it's neurons firing that kind of percolates these various things that you could cook for dinner tonight up. But you don't really have any choice over which selection you get. It seems like it's kind of random if you pay attention to it. And you can make these stories about, you know, why that one seemed better or why those certain things came up. But out of an infinite possibility of choices, right? So if we're back on movies.
Right.
I guarantee if we sat down for 3 days, you could keep remembering names of movies and putting them on a list.
Sure.
And we could put them in alphabetical order. But in a spur of the moment, only a handful show up. And you don't get a choice. You get to choose from the handful, but you don't get a choice of what the handful brings.
Right.
And that is sort of terrifying to me.
So it's kind of like the illusion of free will is still an illusion.
Yeah, that was what he said. Is right. That, you know, yeah. It's...
yeah, because like, even though you have the illusion that you're getting to choose these things, and that's dinner, a movie, what you watch on Netflix, you know, it's still an illusion. And even I think things like Netflix erode that free will, that idea of free will even more, because like, what happens? You're selecting things on Netflix. You're running down a list of stuff. It's showing you things that you're already highly matched to, right? So it's not showing you anything that's outside of the norm of what you've watched. You're not getting any outside influences. You're only you're self-programming, and you're getting these choices based on your own selections, and it's showing you more choices based on those selections. And then when you start, like, let's say you're curious and you just want to see what it's about, it automatically starts. It doesn't even give you the option. It just starts playing. Like, it doesn't even, you know, give you a second to think about it. It already started playing in the background. So it's eroding your ability to choose a little more and more every day.
Well, and I think that analogy is really, really apt, because if you think about how Netflix is suggesting things to you,
right,
it's based off your prior actions,
right,
and based off of prior things that you've watched. But all of your thoughts and all of your decisions are based on prior actions within your life, right? So you have an interaction that ingrains a memory, a neuron, something sure. In your, you know, is it episodic? And what's the other type of memory? Derek was talking about this the other day.
It's episodic, and I don't remember the second one.
Either way.
Yeah.
What you're doing is it's an ingrained, right? So it's all chemical. It's happening within the brain. It's happening at the order of atom.
Sure.
And when you're presented with a choice, what has happened in your past has a direct result on what kind of direction you'll steer.
Right.
And those past experiences present enough things popping up that you can say, okay, I'm going to choose this option. This seems like the rational choice based on my life, based on prior experience. And you might not even be aware of, like, what you'll choose. Like, it could be a subconscious, like, I chose Manal because I know that the highway gets busy and I don't like trying to get off at this exit.
Right.
And, you know, so you can tell yourself that story about why it was, why you chose Manal, but it's really just kind of what you're ingrained, right? It's just kind of an automatic thing. And that's what I find so interesting about, like, thought and decision-making, is that so much of it's automatic, where we think, like, a lot of times it feels like, you know, you're like, oh, I'm going to think about this, and you choose to think about something. But what's your next thought? Did you, you didn't choose if that was a picture.
Right.
You didn't choose if that was a sentence. You didn't choose the context, right?
Right.
When you get distracted and your mind wanders, you don't really choose where you go. It's like clicking on random pages on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you're thinking about, you know, solar systems, and we, because you're spaced out and one thing led to another. And you don't really choose the cascade. You observe the cascade. The cascade happens within your conscious reference.
Right. That stream of thought, yeah.
But you're thinking. And what I think is, like, scary to me is that I'm thinking without realizing that I'm thinking.
Right.
There's, like, that constant inner narrative.
Right.
That's not just the state of your brain. That's not passive reception or consciousness. That's thoughts generating more thoughts, generating more thoughts. And what I'm starting to realize is that those are layered. Like, you can be thinking about five layers of things, and there's, like, this top layer that what is what you're most aware of, but you're kind of, maybe you have a song stuck in your head, and also maybe you're sort of worried about how you're going to make rent this month. Right. And then maybe all, so all of these yeah. things stack. And what I, and you don't get a lot of choice on what's stacking.
Right. Or where in order of importance it's stacked either.
Yeah, so, like, something might feel really important one day, and it might just be that you're feeling extra anxious, or, like, and the amount that physical things can dictate what sort of thoughts you're having. So if you are dehydrated and aren't feeling well physically, you're going to have a different stacking of thoughts controlling the actions of your organism, right?
Right.
So there's going to be all of these external factors that placate to what things are arising within your field of consciousness. And it's scary to me because I when you look closely at it, there isn't much choice to it.
Yeah.
Like, there's small amounts of choice. Like, you can, you know, decide one route versus the other, but the past and prior experience and that which did not occur to you is not really up for choice. So the notion that you have absolute freedom to do whatever you want, I think, is not quite an accurate representation of reality.
Right. It's kind of like that, have you ever heard of Bandersnatch?
Was that the Black Mirror?
It's like a Black Mirror episode that you can choose what happens. Right?
Oh,
so it's like
okay.
a choose your own adventure.
I never ended up watching that.
So it's real freaky in that aspect of, like, there's a set way of things that can happen, but you can choose what when they happen and go in one direction or another. But a lot of the time, you end up in the same place anyway. And so, like, we go back to the Netflix analogy where it's just like, your thoughts are this stream of ideas and this stream of just information and experiences and thoughts that are in your head. And sometimes you can consciously select which ones you want to play, but sometimes you're just browsing through the list and all of a sudden one just starts playing and you have no control over it. You're thinking about, like, why that girl left you in 1998 and, like, why you were wearing JNCO jeans and
everything,
why that tattoo, you know, on your back is starting to fade because you spent too much time in the sun. But you have no control over why you want to think about that stuff or how long you think about it, unless you start the practice of, like, meditation, of hopping out of that stream of thought and just observing. And so that's why people kind of delve into meditation, is because it allows them to exit that stream of thought, experience it, but not judge it, and not get caught up in the rapids of that passing by thought. And that's what happens to a lot of people when they get stuck in like ruminating on things, or they get stuck, you know, in a certain thought pattern. It's just like they're caught in this little whirlpool in the middle of the stream, and they don't know how to get out of it. So they're just trapped. And so the idea is to try to get yourself out of that situation by observing, knowing that that's something that happened, or it's a part of your consciousness, or it's a part of your experience, and just taking a step back and saying, you know, yes, I acknowledge this, but it doesn't have to consume my entire experience or my entire, you know, time. But like, normally people just run with it. They just let these things like go, and over and over and over. It's like, if you ever ask somebody what they're thinking about, and it's like, it's usually just random stuff. And how did they get to that point? Like, they don't know. And so like, where does free will, where does thought come from? And where do these ideas, like, it's all part of the subconscious things that exist within your mind, but you're not consciously processing all the time. It's just they happen to surface, and there's no rhyme or reason to it at all.
Yeah, it's because there, it could be just as conceivable that the default setting when you're not doing critical information processing would just be quiet.
Right, yeah.
Like, why isn't it quiet? It's perplexing.
Right.
Because it seems like it would be more energy efficient, right? Because your brain consumes a majority of your calories, sure. Right? It's always going. And you'd think that unless you were solving a math problem or having a conversation with someone, the default setting would be rest.
Right.
But the default setting is chaos.
Yeah.
And it's yeah, really, really interesting. And one of the things that, you know, I recently tried a longer meditation than I've ever done before. So okay. I did a full like 30 minutes, which doesn't sound like a long time, but it took
a lot. Oh, no, it's a long time.
Took a lot of effort.
Yeah.
And just trying to recognize, like, you get lost in thought without even realizing it. You're all of a sudden, it's just, I haven't been focusing on my breath.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about Thanksgiving again. Or I'm thinking about that awkward interaction I had. Or yeah, I wonder what I can do to fix this person's technique. Like, how often are you falling asleep and then all of a sudden somebody from the gym's snatch errors that day come into your head? And then you go, oh, I have a plan for that.
Yeah, like, I know how to fix that.
It's like, that's not the time for this.
Yeah, brain, we're trying to go to sleep.
So the fact that the thoughts that you have aren't on your side all the time.
Right.
Because a lot of times our thoughts are self-critical or self-deprecating, right, or, you know, these kind of negative ruts of emotion. Right. But I'm wondering, like, what if you don't have a conscious choice over what's arising in consciousness, and all you can really do is acknowledge it or try to redirect and try to get yourself out of those loops, what does that mean for managing emotions? Because if you're not in control of like what's popping up, it's a matter of kind of just recognizing and letting it go. But it's weird because you even the way that we speak about this doesn't, we don't have the right vocabulary, because
right,
no matter what we say, you have to choose to not dwell on these thoughts,
right,
or you have to let these thoughts go. But that's thinking. So like, if you observe a thought and you go, oh, I shouldn't be thinking about that, you just thought again.
Right. Yeah.
So it's not, it's being the observer can only, like, I mean, I've never done it, but I think that, you know, that disillusionment can only happen for like the fraction of a second. And as soon as you catch yourself, I wasn't thinking, you're thinking again.
Right.
And it's so perplexing to me that it's not under your volitional control.
Right. And that's why I kind of like look at it in the analogy of being a stream of thought. Like, it never stops coming, but you never see where it's flowing from either. You're just in the middle of it. So when you get caught up, you're just, you don't see the end of the thought, and you don't see the beginning of the thought. You're just right there standing in the middle of the stream. And so unless you're training yourself to consciously exit out of that process and just observe it, then you're just stuck in the middle of the stream until it's over, until you run to the next thought and the next thought and the next thought. And that's what, like, how people go about their daily lives, is just from one random thought to the next. And there's no rhyme or reason to when they come or why they come or what shows up. But like, the idea is to get away from the reactions of emotion, because thoughts bring emotions into play a lot of time. And I think it's more so for women than men. Like, more women have more emotions attached to thoughts and feelings than guys do. So like for me, when I think about something, I don't always attach an emotion to it, but sometimes thoughts and memories can be emotional. But stepping back and out of that stream of thought just allows me to observe those things and say, you know, I don't want to participate in that thought today, or I don't want to participate in that right now. I observe it. I know that it existed in that certain moment in time, but I don't have to dwell on that, and I can just let it go, and the next thought will come in. Or if you're really good at meditating, then you can get out of that process entirely and at some point experience that small stillness that happens in breaks and points. Like, you don't meditate and spend 30 minutes in stillness and silence. Like, that's real hard to do. More of it is just like battling where you're at, like returning to the breath, returning to that moment of stillness and silence. And so that's the hard part. And that's what I think. I don't know if people try to avoid that or not. Like, have you ever, like, I've asked people, can you sit by yourself for 10 minutes in total silence? And not everybody's like willing to do that.
Oh, I'm terrible at it. So this is kind of tangentially related, but so I'm kind of a voracious consumer of podcasts, sure, and news and YouTube videos. And I'm always like trying to learn something. I don't like to like be still.
Yeah.
In doing so, I find a lot of kind of interesting things, and I kind of have these kind of interesting thoughts, and I get to kind of have some fun kind of playing with ideas.
Sure.
But what I worry about sometimes is I'll get thoughts in my head, right? And I'll realize that these are things that I've heard other people say, right? It's like, you know, like a comedian that steals a joke without realizing it, right? Yeah. So like what I sometimes worry about, and what causes me kind of some distress, and why I'm trying to really like refocus on my meditation practice, is like I don't know how to differentiate my ideas from ideas that I've heard. Like, I don't know how to, because like I'm sure that, you know, so like when you're writing programming, right?
Yeah.
You're thinking through the lens of the last thing you read.
Right.
So like, am I using Bob Takano's ideas, or am I influencing my ideas by Bob Takano's ideas? And like, when somebody puts a thought in your head, because that can happen, right? So you're listening to something, yeah, and they make a point and you go, dang, that's really, that's cool, I like that, yeah, point. And then that's circulating in your head. They put that there. That's not from you.
Right.
So what I'm struggling with right now is trying to identify like what parts of what I'm thinking about are from me, right, and what parts are like toxic things that I'm bringing in from, you know, like Instagram comments, or yeah, like, because I find that when I deep dive into a topic, whether it's political science or philosophy or training, that's what populates my mind that day. And I sometimes worry, like, is it bad to have your head entirely populated with other people's ideas all the time? Like, I worry that I might be consuming too much information. Like, I it might be so much overload that there's never like integration happening.
Right.
You know?
And I, you know, I struggle with that too, but maybe I think about it to a lesser degree, because I, more recently than not, I've been thinking about like, where do my ideas come from? Like, why do I think what I think? Why do I do what I do, and what drives that behavior? And like, do I think about a certain subject because I'm interested in it, or because it was brought to my attention by something else? And this is true for programming too. It's like when I'm programming for other people, I'm influenced by the previous programming that I've seen, not just my own, but other people's programming and other people's ideas as well. So it's not entirely like a unique version of my own ideas. It's a conglomeration. It's this amalgam of ideas and thoughts that have come together, and then I'm putting them on the paper. And so maybe it's some of our thoughts and ideas are our own, but it's also a melding of some of the other things and ideas and experiences that we've had and shared, and maybe, you know, that other people have shared with us as well. So it's just like we're continually processing this information, both on our own side, but from other people's perspective as well. And so that's one thing that makes us unique as human beings, is that we're able to step into the shoes of other people and look at their point of view, right? That it's not an egocentric point of view. We're able to put ourselves in other people's positions. But how much do those positions influence us on an individual basis? And how much are we carrying out our own actions and intentions because of what we decided to do, as opposed to what other people have told us or external inputs that we've gotten? You know, it's just like whenever, like, I always struggle with this with Instagram, for especially, is just like, who am I posting this for? Like, who is this for? Like, if I post a picture of, you know, me and my mom for Mother's Day, she doesn't even have Instagram. She doesn't know how to use a computer. Like, who am I posting that for? Is it just likes for me so I can get some attention on the side? Because she's not going to see it. You know, she doesn't feel better or more grateful because I mentioned her in an Instagram post.
Yeah.
But, like, who is that for? And it's just those thoughts, those types of behaviors that, like, we perpetuate on different levels of everyday life, but we don't necessarily think about why we're doing them or who they're for.
Yeah, and I think that that's what worries me, is that if your thoughts drive your actions and you're never really discerning between the talking points you heard on the news and your own opinions, you know, these sort of things can lead you into, you know, maybe not... not living the examined life, right?
Yeah.
Where you're not really kind of looking at, like, well, why is that in my head today? Like, why am I so mad about taxes right now? It's like, oh, yeah. Well, I may have listened to too many libertarian podcasts yeah. last week, and right. now I'm just screaming about taxation being theft. And then that fades after a while. So yeah. I think that we're all susceptible to, if you get caught in a loop or you get really deep dived into one subject, you start seeing everything through that lens.
Right.
And that's why I try to consume as much variety and information as I can, especially with programming, because I don't want to get caught in a rut of this is the way that we do it, because right. this is the way that we do it, because this is the way that we do it.
Or we've always done it that way, so we're just going to keep doing it because it works.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, continuing to try new things and try, you know, so there's periods of time where I consciously try not to get any new information, but yeah. just try to use the current information I have slightly differently, or like try to re-look at some things that I haven't read in a while. So like I'm always going back and trying to refresh, because sometimes I'll get to a thing and someone will say, like, oh, we're, you know, like, what is, like, we're doing three high pulls and a power snatch, and they're like, oh, okay, well, why are we doing this? And I have a reason, you know. It's, oh, we're working on, it's less fatiguing than doing a high rep set of power snatches, but you get one power snatch at the end and you're moving the bar really fast.
Sure.
So there's the rationalization, right? That's why we did this. But then upon reflection, it was like, oh, well, actually, I saw this in a Bob Takano book.
Yeah.
And I recognized it and assigned it value as, I recognize that this is a speed power exercise and a way to mitigate loading. But he never said that. He just had it as an example of an exercise.
Yeah.
And I assigned it that story. But really, I did it because I saw it.
Right.
And then I made up a narrative about what it does. And I think that that's really interesting, is that a lot of things that you kind of say or do, or like, you know, you notice that people tell the same stories.
Yeah.
You know, they're reinforcing.
Yeah, they're
redeveloping. We've probably had this conversation on episode 5. Like, these sort of things are recurring, and sometimes you can catch a glimpse of, oh, I know the origin of that idea. I know where that planted itself
right.
in my head. But then, you know, the example of the three pulls and a snatch, he never said, like, this is to help leg drive and bar height and these sort of things. Those are things that I assigned to it. So those were kind of my ideas seeping into an example idea that I saw. Okay. And I think that it's really... I don't know. I think that that's why, you know, you talk about, you know, people having charlatan syndrome, where, crap, do I actually know anything
yeah, yeah.
about what I'm doing? And I think that where I struggle is, if I've, sometimes I have a hard time, like, if I know that this is an idea that I took from someone else because it made sense, right, and I use it, I don't always count that as, like, knowledge, right?
That's true, yeah.
So, like, sometimes I think of it as, like, I have all of these things, but most of them I didn't create my understanding of the snatch pull. I learned it from somebody else. Right. And, you know, sometimes it feels like, it's like, well, why would I make an informative video when, like, I just got this from an informative video,
sure,
or
yeah,
I got this from a book. So why would I write a book about a book that I read?
Right.
So, like, what counts?
But people do that all the time, though.
Oh, people do it all the time. Like, I've been coaching for 2 years. Check out my ebook. You know, yeah, like, it's not, like, and it's really, it's weird because I think it comes down to, you know, the, what counts as knowledge. Yeah. And I feel like a lot of times when you really care and you're really interested in ideas, you kind of recognize that there's nothing new to what you're doing.
Right.
You're finding old ideas,
yeah,
and you're applying them in new situations.
There's nothing new under the sun.
But you're not making new,
yeah,
new stuff. And I think that's why I have a hard time, you know, why we don't do little technique write-ups.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of people doing that really well, and I don't have anything different to contribute.
You'd just be adding a different face to the same information.
Yeah, and I think that it's just really weird to kind of have to take that step back.
But it also could be good in the sense that, like, only you can convey the information the way you know it and the way you understand it to other people. So while it may be repetitive in nature across the board, right, because somebody else has probably made a technique video the same way, the way that you explain it, the way that you come across, the verbiage that you use, and the way that you portray that can all be different, and in that case, unique. And that's why people write books, right? They develop these stories, whether it's autobiographical in nature or a fictional novel. Like, people make up these stories so that the information can be passed on, because we don't all derive information from all the same sources. We're constantly getting it from different areas of our lives. So a technique video that you may have watched, I may have never seen, but if you make that video, I'll know the information because you've passed it on in your own way.
Well, and that's what I think is so interesting versus like a subjective versus an outside perspective. Because subjectively, it feels like I'm always learning and I'm always piecing things together. But then when somebody asks me a question, I'll have an answer and I'll have a why.
Right.
And it's like, oh, okay. So to me, that doesn't seem like firm knowledge because I feel like I'm still learning.
Sure.
But when I have to answer a question, I go, oh, wow, I did know that. So it's kind of a funny thing where, you know,
but all,
I guess what we're all worried
like
about
that,
is like Dunning-Krugering ourselves. Where
right.
It's like,
yeah,
I'm so confident and I know everything about this, but really you're just scratching the surface.
Yeah.
And it goes back to that revisiting the fundamentals of technique, where if you're kind of so sure that you know how to snatch, double check, because you might find something new there. So revisiting, you know, the basis of your ideas and revisiting your technique, and then just questioning whether or not you had any choice to be a weightlifter at all is kind of where we're going to leave you guys this week.
Yeah, so that that's the perfect way to end the podcast. That concludes today's episode. I hope you all got something out of it, at least something interesting to talk about and bring up with other people.
Yeah, but bring it up at Thanksgiving.
Yeah,
make it weird.
Yeah, talk to your parents about their free will and see what they have to say about it. See what kind of argument that starts. All right. So if y'all have any questions, I think we're going to do a Q&A episode maybe next week.
I think
so we'll throw out some questions on Instagram. If you have questions, just send them to Albuquerque Strength Academy on Instagram, or you can use our website to contact us and send some questions that way. We'll also probably throw up a story with, you know, just asking for some general questions. But we had a pretty good turnout last time and hope we can accomplish the same thing this time. Anything else you want to add, Grayson?
No, guys, please like and subscribe to the podcast. It really gives us an advantage on iTunes. Give us 5 stars and let's get weird philosophy and weightlifting tips combined out to everybody. So share the podcast if you're enjoying it, and we'll see you guys next week.
All right, until next time, lift with no regrets, y'all.